everyone, and welcome to Risky Business episode 229. I'm Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we're catching up with Mr. Popular himself, Mr. Adrian Lamo. Adrian is best known as the guy who turned in alleged WikiLeaks source Bradley Manning, but he has some interesting perspectives on the LulzSec arrests, and he'll be along to share them soon. And yeah, if you haven't heard about the LulzSec / anonymous arrests, well, it's time to climb out from under that great big rock you've been hiding under that's in the cave in the center of the mountain, because, yeah, pretty big news. This week's show is sponsored by Tenable Network Security, makers of fine information security software. And in this week's sponsor interview, Tenable product manager Jack Daniel will be along to have a chat about a recent Tenable webinar, which was all about the internal politics of security. If you're struggling to get your colleagues on side, you might want to have a listen to that one. But before all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, of course, the massive news of the week is that the hackers formerly known as LulzSec, a bunch of key sort of anonymous figures, have been rounded up in raids in the United States and Britain. And the shocker development in all of this is it turns out the LulzSec ringleader, Sabu, had actually been flipped by the FBI as far back as July, August last year. And yeah, he's shopped out all his buddies.
Yeah, well, it's certainly been an interesting few days on Twitter and IRC, hearing everybody's many and varied opinions on this. Largely that the fact that Sabu is a snitch, is a surprise to some and not a surprise to very many, I think. But yeah, it's interesting. They finally have, kind of swooped in and rounded everybody up. The fact that Sabu was, turned snitch when he disappeared for a month, sometime was it August last year, I guess is pretty interesting for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I guess that's, largely how they would have been able to round up these other guys. Although that said, you read some of the court documents and have a look at some of the stories out there and you realize that their OPSEC, these guys, their OPSEC wasn't just bad, it was just awful.
Well, I mean, in places it was pretty reasonable. The fact that they lasted as long as they did, I guess, is testament to the fact they were doing some OPSEC. But yeah, by and large, infighting amongst the crews and, sloppy OPSEC is what got them busted in the end. I mean, the fact that, Sabu originally got doxed, it appears, through a mispaste in IRC, which, I mean, we've all done that at some point. OPSEC is hard to get right, every time, which is, of course, what you have to do when you are hacking the FBI.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a story that's doing the rounds. The best version I could find was actually on the ThreatPost website, which, ThreatPost doesn't suck. It's like an AV company's blog, and it's actually pretty good. But there's a good write up there about how a group, what are they called? They're Backtrace Security, were able to actually, comprehensively dox Sabu, aka Hector Javier Montsegur. I don't know, I probably mispronounced that as well. But they actually doxed him pretty good because of that mispaste. But yeah, I mean, it looks like Sabu had been named as being a few different people. So it's kind of easy in retrospect to point back and go, they got it right, but plenty of people got it wrong.
Well, yeah, and it's it's kind of interesting how it's gone down, I suppose. Like the fact that it took them however many months, since they turned Sabu to actually manage to round up everybody else. And especially there's been some articles going around describing how they were tracking people across Tor by virtue of essentially traffic analysis in the very literal sense. Like someone was sitting outside one of the suspect's houses and when he went in the door, phoning up the equivalent FBI agent who was hanging out with Sabu, saying, "Did this guy just turn up on IRC across Tor?" And then corresponding the times when they disappeared and reappeared on the IRC network based on their physical appearance in and out of their house and stuff. So I mean, it's quite interesting that they had to do that kind of thing over such a long period of time to get them.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty standard thing. I mean, usually when you're running a line intercept, I know that this is the case in Australia when they're running a line intercept on someone. You know, to see if they're committing crimes, they usually require some sort of proof that the person was actually at the premises at the time, and usually that's a officer actually outside the house. You know, basically verifying their presence in the building. I think they can do that with you know, listening devices or, you know, cameras or whatever. But yeah, they definitely need to be quite sure. Now, the first thing that occurred to me when this happened is, okay, these are the guys who allegedly ripped off Stratfor's email, right? Correct?
Yeah.
Okay, Stratfor's email is now being published by WikiLeaks. Yes. WikiLeaks does not have a submission service anymore, which means that the handover of that email to WikiLeaks would have been a negotiated thing. Now, this means that WikiLeaks has been accepting the submission or negotiating negotiating to obtain, illegally obtained data with a group of people that have been infiltrated for the FBI. Now, this, as far as I'm concerned, has got to make Julian Assange's lawyers a little bit nervous.
Well, exactly. And this is a very interesting twist in the story. I mean, like the WikiLeaks Stratfor thing, you know, we've discussed plenty enough, but the idea that, you know, the FBI, you know, purposely leaked this or caused it to go to WikiLeaks specifically to try and implicate them or to, you know, catch them encouraging, you know, Lulzsec Anonymous to go out and, you know, get stolen or steal this data, hand it over to them under whatever terms. And as you say, especially without the benefit of their much vaunted submission system, it's a very, very sort of I mean, as you say, I imagine that Julian's lawyers are a little bit twitchy about this.
Yeah,
it doesn't really look very good for them, does it?
Well, it depends. I mean, we've seen a few tweets flying around this week from some Anons saying stuff like, look, you know, Sabu tried negotiating with WikiLeaks and actually demanding payment for the information. Now, I imagine that would certainly bolster the case for extradition. And it would help, you know, certainly help to tar WikiLeaks as being an organization that was inappropriately aligned with a group of criminals, right? So, but
was
I can't.
That Kevin called them last week the document laundering arm of Anonymous.
Yes, the document. I mean, how amazing is that? That, I mean, the stuff that he said last week, you can really see, you know, Kevin's analysis, and then you can look at the events of the last few days and really see that that would be what the DOJ in the US would be going for if they were trying to actually dismantle WikiLeaks, eh?
Well, exactly, yeah, yeah. And, you know, by all accounts, it looks like they're doing a pretty reasonable job of heading in that direction, you know, based on this.
Well, we don't know because, I mean, it has been said also on Twitter that WikiLeaks didn't go for the whole, you know, money exchange thing. But, you know, as you say, if they could get some WikiLeaks person on, you know, through some sort of surveilled communication saying, yes, we want you to go after this sort of information. Can you go after these sort of contractors? I mean, that is, you know, a hop, skip and a jump away. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I imagine it's a hop, skip and a jump away from proving that WikiLeaks is sort of part of a criminal conspiracy. So, yeah, fine lines being walked all over the place at the moment. And I have a feeling that in a few months we might discover details of the ramifications of these arrests for WikiLeaks.
Well, yeah, and also, I mean, I suppose one of the victims here, of course, is Stratfor. You got to wonder how they feel being thrown under the wheels by the FBI, effectively.
Oh, well, come on, that email was always going to leak. It was always going to go out by, you know, it would have gone out like HB Gary's mail went out. One of the things I find very interesting, though, is when you float this argument, people say, oh, but that would be entrapment, which just proves that people don't really understand what entrapment means.
Well, yeah, I don't particularly understand the legal definition of entrapment either. But some of the articles I've read, you know, do suggest that it's a pretty hard defense to run.
Well, there's a really good one on SC Magazine, magazine's website, where they've interviewed a lawyer who said that, you know, you'd have to show the government actually had you do something. You sort of need to show that you've been backed into a corner. You also need to show that this person was doing something they wouldn't have done otherwise, if it weren't for the government inducement. So it's kind of like, it's pretty hard to prove entrapment. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess especially in light of, you know, Lulzsec's earlier activities, you can't really say it's not the sort of thing they did.
Exactly. In the wake of the arrests, there was at least one defacement. Panda Security, I think it was like their blog or something, where one of their bloggers had said, you know, oh, it's good that these guys all got arrested and blah, blah, blah. And of course, they got SQL injected and defaced. And a open letter to Sabu was actually posted on the site in which Key Anons expressed their disappointment with him turning snitch.
Yeah, it was a pretty funny defacement, actually. I have to admit, I did lull a little bit. But yeah, they also, you know, claimed, and I'm not sure if there's any evidence whatsoever, to have backdoored Panda's antivirus products and, you know, dropped a bunch of passwords and other things from their infrastructure. So probably not a particularly fun day down there at pandasecurity.com. But yeah, otherwise, for the rest of us, probably a little bit entertaining.
So they're sad pandas.
Oh, I see what you did there. I do see what you did there.
Now, yes. Last bit of Anon news for the week. And a whole bunch of anonymous supporters, you know, they go to their pastebin guides on how you can join the anonymous army and fight the man. You know, and you can you can download, what is it? What's the tool called?
This was what? It was Loic, wasn't it?
Slow Loris.
Oh, yeah, Slow Loris, yeah.
So you can download Slow Loris and join the DDoS army. Someone basically just took that paste and then edited the download link to a download of a Zeus Trojan copy of Slow Loris, which people dutifully installed. And Symantec did a good write-up of this where they were looking at the number of times that link appeared on Twitter. And yeah, it seems that it's a pretty popular link and that a whole bunch of wannabe Anons are kind of getting owned.
It was pretty funny. Symantec's write-up went through and the found, you know, some of the links to the Trojan article were actually then reincorporated into later editions of the legitimate one.
Yeah.
So it ended up kind of propagating around like that and all sorts of kids getting owned, which is, you know, ironic and most entertaining.
Oh, now speaking of Symantec, this is some breaking news that we're not really going to get a chance to cover properly this week, but apparently Norton's antivirus source codes hit the tubes.
Yeah, it looks like it has turned up on the Pirate Bay and is you know, being downloaded by all sorts of people, being monitored by all sorts of feds, no doubt.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. There's been a little bit of to and fro between myself and Symantec discussing the sort of significance of that code and whether or not it was going to be released. So now that it comes out, we'll have to just watch and see if their attitude changes. Also, other news: Crest, certified.
Registered ethical security testery.
Yeah, pen like test certification or whatever. It's coming to Australia. This is again breaking news. It's been coming for a while, but Australia's Attorney General announced that it has been established in Australia with government support. So we'll bring you some more news on that next week. But moving on to something that we discussed last week, we had a chat about Chrome's Ponium contest versus the traditional CanSec West Pwn to Own contest. These are, of course, the contests where, you know, you receive prizes for owning some box. There were two parallel contests this year, and both of them have had entries, and Chrome has been owned twice.
Yeah, so it's certainly been a bit different from earlier Pwn to Own competitions, I think. One of the things that I think has come out of the result this year, which is, as you said, Chrome being owned in both the Ponium and the Pwn to Own and nothing else whatsoever, no other entries at all, I guess suggests that the value of these bugs in the wild really is exceeding the kind of money that they're offering at Pwn to Own. So we saw Sergei Glazunov, who's a Russian guy from the wastelands of Siberia, apparently, who's been collecting quite a lot of Chrome bounties over the last year or so. He turned up with a working turned up via a proxy with a working Chrome bug and sandbox escape, apparently. Although I gather it's not any sort of memory corruption; it's some kind of logic bug.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Vupin guys turned up and threw down in the Pwn to Own side of the fence.
Now, this is really funny. This part is really funny.
Yeah, well, they turned up with a functional Chrome bug and basically thumbed their nose at Google and said, "We're not giving you the sandbox escape," and proceeded to, you know, walk away with 60K from the Pwn to Own guys instead.
Well, and the really funny part is Google actually came up and said, "Look, we'll give you another 60K if you give us your sandbox bypass." And the Vupin guys just said, "Yeah, no, I don't think that'll be happening. Maybe for a million," they said.
Yeah. And of course, the Vupin guys apparently also are sitting on bugs on all the other browsers as well, which they will deploy if they need to, if somebody else turns up in the competition. But yeah, no one else is.
Yeah, we'll just take the 60K, and if you turn up and waste your bug, we'll just smash you with some more.
Yeah, well, I don't think anyone's going to go into that room with, Vupin in there showing off their the size of their exploits.
That's a big exploit you got there, buddy. Now,
heap overflow in your pocket, or no, anyway,
just happy to see me. Linode, which is a very popular sort of massive hosting company, which offers sort of, you know, virtual boxins on the intertubes, has been owned pretty majorly by a group of people who targeted users storing bitcoins on those boxes. Apparently, they got away with about $228,000US dollars worth of Bitcoin booty.
Yeah, so it looks like these dudes, they owned the management system, like the platform management system that Linode provided to their customers to manage their, you know, VPS servers, and then went through and targeted machines that had anything to do with Bitcoin, had any Bitcoin wallets on them, went around and helped themselves to all the Bitcoins they found. And one guy had 46K Bitcoin. You know, just kind of knock it around here. I think they were running a Bitcoin exchange, this particular guy. And as you say, like, that's, you know, the big end of 200K US dollars, plus a few other people who lost, you know, a couple of thousand here and there. And finally, also Gavin Andreessen, who's one of the Bitcoin developers, lost the 5 Bitcoin he had knocking around in his box.
Well, who stores Bitcoins on a box at a shared host? I mean,
well, exactly right. It really, I mean, you know, it's like leaving your wallet in your pants while they're at the dry cleaner or something. You know, it's just it's really not a very smart plan. and you know, the fact that Linode became a target because of their customers storing, you know, money in their boxes, is something that, you know, I think a lot of hosting providers should probably start to take fairly seriously, like a real direct financial incentive for their customers getting owned beyond the regular, you know, credit card theft.
You may not store possession of valuables at own risk.
I mean, you would, right? Hotels do exactly that. Yeah. Right? Why wouldn't a hosting provider?
Yeah, no, it just seems, it seems a little bit of a weird way to store your money to me as well.
Well, exactly. Yeah, totally agree. Well, the whole Bitcoin thing is a pretty weird way to store your money, regardless of where you put it. But yeah, on somebody else's VPS platform, really bad plan.
Yeah, not so good. Now, speaking of doing it wrong, GitHub apparently had misconfigured Rails, which basically made their entire platform completely vulnerable to all sorts of nastiness. This was pretty serious business.
Yeah, this has been, you know, a lot of people have been up in arms and, you know, flailing about on the Twitters with wailing and gnashing of beaks, I suppose.
Wailing and gnashing of beaks, I like that.
Well, it's
that,
on Twitter,
well
right?
Done.
The beak with the bird. Yeah.
Anyway, I get it.
You get it, right? Yeah, you with your f***ing panda joke. I got to make something. But yeah, anyway, so there was essentially a misconfiguration in Rails, and the Rails application which ran GitHub was misconfigured in this way that allowed people to, you know, essentially take over and get write access to your Git repositories hosted on GitHub, which was, let's face it, a pretty bad thing. And lots of things are hosted on GitHub that are, you know, fairly high profile and used all over the place. And it certainly had the potential to be horrifically bad. But then on the other hand, right, we've seen SourceForge get owned how many times, and Red Hat and Debian, and, you know, everyone else gets their code repositories owned, and, you know, the world hasn't ended yet.
So everybody gets owned anyway, so don't worry about it. I like it. Well, that's a good attitude.
It's certainly not a good look, but also it didn't seem particularly reassuring how GitHub handled it. So yeah, a lot of people had kind of issues with that.
Well, yeah, they locked out. The guy had been reporting it. They kept saying, oh, it's not a bug. And then when he demoed it by posting something to be timestamped like 1,000 years in the future,
which was quite funny,
they like locked him out and shut down his account and stuff. But but I like it that we can take a new moral from this, the Metal Storm theory of information security, which is can't win, don't try.
The only winning move is not to play.
Yeah, so a bunch of dudes hacked into Sony Music and stole the entire back catalog for the King of Pop himself, Michael Jackson. Now, you might think, okay, whatever, seems a rather convoluted way to go about expanding your MP3 collection. But there's unreleased stuff there, including a duet with Freddie Mercury. And I'm just thinking, Michael Jackson and Freddie Mercury duet, why haven't we seen this before? Release it.
Yeah, well, Sony are claiming this is worth something like, what, $250 million worth tracks, including, as you said, Freddie Mercury, Will I Am for the Black Eyed Peas, a bunch of other duets. Paul Simon, apparently, as well.
Oh, no, I think that's his. It's also Paul Simon's back catalog and Jimi Hendrix's and Avril Lavigne.
She has a back catalog.
Zing. But, you know, I mean, if there's unreleased Jimi Hendrix stuff there, I don't know. I mean, they say that there's this unreleased Freddie Mercury thing, but unreleased Jimi Hendrix, I reckon anyone who had access to the music, you know, to musical works by Jimi Hendrix that were not released, that they actually sat on, they deserve to feel the fury of 1,000 fires of hell. I will hold the poker, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Would you please release it on Pirate Bay? Okay, thanks. Whoever it is who stole it, that would be grand.
Yes, we would like to hear Jimi Hendrix's unreleased music. But yeah, so big problems for Sony Music potentially there. Now, look, this next piece I think is actually quite fascinating and very, it's most interesting, you would say. It comes to us via ThreatPost. Some guys were analyzing the Dooku virus. This is like the son or father or related in some way to Stuxnet. It's like, you know, spookware, basically. Now, there's a component of one of the DLLs that it uses where they've reversed it and realized that it was written in a computer language that is, drumroll please, unknown.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I guess when you're reversing when you're reversing stuff, often, you know, stuff can take a while to sort of resolve in your mind as to exactly what it is. And when you see something that has been built, with a compiler or a tool chain that you've never seen before, it certainly can look very weird. And I'm sure that these guys are, you know, particularly experienced in reversing stuff. And if they say it's something they haven't seen before, that is kind of interesting. But I guess on the other hand, right, we've seen a long history of malware writers inventing their own languages or their own macro assemblers, or in some cases their own, you know, entire virtual machine to run their own interpreted bytecode, specifically in order to make it more difficult to reverse or do, runtime analysis and antivirus and that sort of thing. So I guess I'm not particularly surprised that, you know, mil and gov grade spookware, as you say, is a little more complicated, a little more obscure than your off-the-shelf Zeus Trojan.
Moving on very quickly, Apple is fixing 81 security holes in its latest release of iOS. Most of them are WebKit bugs, but there's a couple of real serious ones in there that are being patched.
Yeah, there is. There's a bunch of bugs. You know, everything from, you know, browser bugs to sandbox escapes to like lock screen swipe to unlock bugs. A real set of them. Things in all throughout the operating system. So yeah. You should probably go forth and patch yourself fairly immediately.
Yeah, I noticed actually this is the first time I've ever had an over-the-air update for a iOS patch. So, interesting.
Yeah, you should enjoy that instead of the, 700 meg of iTunes download.
Yeah, that's it. Except it's probably roasted my nuts by downloading it in the background. Now, from the shitty journalism files, we're going to wrap up this week's show by having a look at a couple of pieces that ran this week in the Australian media that are just, you know, truly awful bits of journalism. Just hang your head in shame. Exhibit A comes from CSO Magazine here in Australia. This piece is headlined "Zero Damage from Last Year's RSA Breach" and goes on to quote exclusively the chief executive of RSA, who's been visiting Sydney. Now, what the fuck? I mean, how can CSO Magazine, how can you claim to have any credibility when you run single-sourced stories like this, where all you've got is the CEO of RSA saying our breach wasn't a big deal?
Yeah, well, yeah, I read this headline and, like, you know, almost spat my lunch out on the spot. You know, like, what the no damage? Like, yeah, really? That you would actually come out and say this? And yeah, like, just straight up take the word of the CEO and not do any sort of investigation whatsoever. I mean, you know, okay, what about the Lockheed Martin thing, for example? About all the, you know, all the banks who had to run around, you know, turning off their two-factor auth, finding a replacement, talking to, trying to get good information about RSA as to what their risk exposure was, and you call this zero f***ing damage?
Yeah, and Lockheed, they say, well, Lockheed repelled the attack. We don't know that, as if they're going to admit it if they weren't. And how many of these attacks were undetected? How many people needed to reprovision tokens? How many people needed to shut down access? Massive disruption, and I'm sure that people got owned through this. You don't go to all of that trouble of owning a company like RSA and stealing that information if you're not going to use it. I mean, it's just, I'm just staggered that CSO would actually run it. Now, the other bit of Exhibit B this week comes to us via Fairfax newspapers, who've written a whole story on the sale of exploit information, which sort of portrays the sale of exploits to governments as being this awesome defensive thing that they can use them to plug into IDS signatures. What the
this article is particularly entertaining. Like, it talks about the concept of bug sales without, you know, any sort of contextual information about what's going on in the industry and the the realities of how everything works, completely by itself, like without any reference to the outside world, which is not exactly the way to make yourself look credible.
No, so Sydney Morning Herald, Age, you know, Fairfaxy guys, plus CSO Magazine, this week you are just dunces. Go to the naughty corner, no biscuit.
Yeah, big pile of turds for both of you.
That's right. And Adam, unfortunately, that's it. We're going to have to end on that bum note. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
All right, I'll talk to you next week, Pat.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Now, don't forget that you can contact me at patrick@risky.biz, P-A-T-R-I-C-K at risky.biz. If you are interested in finding a new information security job here in Australia, I'm on the lookout currently for penetration testers, incident responders, post-intrusion analysts, I guess you'd call them, security architects and more. So email me for more details. I am also always on the lookout for podcast sponsors. If your company would like to find out why sponsoring Risky Business is an awesome idea, then by all means, get in touch. patrick@risky.biz. Okay, it's time for this week's feature interview now, and we're having a chat about those LulzSec arrests with Adrian Lamo. Adrian used to be known as the homeless hacker. Around a decade ago, he roamed America, often sleeping in abandoned buildings while he would steal Wi-Fi and hack into a whole bunch of high-profile targets. But his was a grey hat affair. He would contact his victims afterwards and tell them how he'd done it. But inevitably, one of his targets took issue eventually with his free penetration testing services, and they pressed charges. That victim was the New York Times. After a brief stint on the run, Adrian turned himself in and was sentenced to a period of home detention. I think it was around a year or two. Flash forward to 2010, and Lamo was in the headlines again for an entirely different set of reasons. He'd turned in a young Army intelligence analyst by the name of Bradley Manning. He had alleged the then 22-year-old was providing WikiLeaks with classified information, like the State Department cables, so-called collateral murder video, and the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs. According to Lamo, Manning had approached him online and just sort of spilled his guts over IM. Now, after wrestling with it for a while, Adrian says he decided to drop a dime on Manning because the information he was leaking could endanger lives and the broader security, the broader national security of the United States. Now, snitching isn't a great way to win friends in the hacker community. So since that time, Adrian has become somewhat unpopular, shall we say, in that community. But for our purposes, that kind of makes him the perfect guest to talk about today's topic, the arrest of key anonymous figures. Basically, they hate him already, so he's not worried about pissing them off and drawing their attention. He can speak freely. You would be amazed how many people are too scared to get those guys offside, so they will just never say anything critical. So I started off by asking Adrian if he thought it was inevitable that the law would eventually catch up with the LulzSec hackers.
Oh my God, yes. What were they thinking targeting the federal investigative authorities? The Bureau especially is well known for pursuing investigations that affect their image for years upon years. They have all the time in the world, whereas, as I have said elsewhere, the individuals who actually committed the acts will only grow older, acquire families, acquire careers, and gain more things to lose, while the Bureau will only have more to gain.
Mm. Now, you've had some exposure to the FBI. You've been on the receiving end of charges, obviously. I mean, was there an attempt to sort of coerce you into becoming some sort of informant for the FBI? This is, you know, I'm talking roughly 10 years ago when you'd gone fugitive, and then later when they caught up with you. Was there an attempt for them to sort of enlist you as some sort of helper?
I spent pretty much a full day in the company of, or actually the custody of FBI agents from the New York City Cyber Division. And yes, they did make clear that were I to cooperate in bringing in others, that I would receive a more lenient sentence. However, I couldn't morally justify that. That was a very, very different concept than putting Bradley Manning in the crosshairs. So I refused. And as it turned out, their mishandling of my case caused enough humiliation that the Department of Justice had to apologize on their behalf. After that, I never again saw my case agent at a hearing. She just disappeared.
So let me ask you, I mean, when they do put on the pressure, when they are turning the screws, they would turn them pretty tight, I'd imagine.
They wanted 5 to 10 years for me, as well as well over $1 million in damages. That being said, I did not believe that they had the information or evidence to back up such an assertion or such a sentence, given at the time sentencing guidelines, and I declined to cooperate with them in any way at that time. That said, it's really, really easy to look at Sabu and say that he was just out for his own interests, but his kids were online. I'm not saying that it's right to put your own interests ahead of those of a multitude of others, but it's understandable.
Yeah, I mean, this guy was facing 124 years in prison, according to reports. And, I mean, we even saw, I'm sure you would have caught that some Lulzsec affiliates defaced a Panda security blog or something like that. You know, they put up an open letter to Sabu, where it almost seemed that they were saying they understood because his kids were there. You know, you were looking after your family, but remember, we were your family too. I mean, it also seemed, Adrian, that the word was kind of out last year after he disappeared around July for a month and then came back. There were a lot of rumors swirling around that this guy was had been flipped by law enforcement. I'm kind of surprised that didn't insulate people from, you know, that people didn't choose to insulate and isolate themselves from doing illegal stuff with the guy, right?
Well, my response to that is bifurcated. First, there are almost constant allegations that X person is working for the feds in the scene. It's easy to look back in retrospect and say, yes, that allegation was there. Why wasn't it obvious? But the same allegations were made about others surrounding him. So at the time, it wasn't so clear.
Yeah, so if you believe everything on Pastebin, you know, you're kind of in trouble, right?
Right. Lulzsec, in fact, tried to deflect responsibility onto me by registering their domain in my name.
that can't have been a serious disinformation attempt. That would have been just, I don't know, that seems like kind of a joke that they would have done, right?
You'd think so, but to this day, I still get contacts from people who are of the belief that I was involved in creating some kind of clandestine operation there.
That's amazing. It's funny actually, because you've drawn my attention over the last couple of years to some pretty funny conspiracy theories that involve you. My favorite one was the YouTube video you sent me, which purported to identify you as some sort of like B-grade soap actor, and that you were like in fact part of some massive CIA conspiracy to, you know, wind up releasing information to WikiLeaks or something like that. But you're an actor apparently. That one was pretty good.
Yeah, I get the allegation that I'm working on behalf of the CIA a lot. It's kind of funny, actually.
Yeah, no, I liked it that you were an actor and catalog model who, you know, and they identified you by looking at your, they identified you by looking at various points on your ears. Yeah, anyway, that was kind of interesting. Would you anticipate these Lulzsec guys are going to wind up with pretty hefty custodial sentences? Because it's my impression that they will.
You know, as I said before, they did some pretty bad things. I say that from my perspective as an analysis of moral motivations. They acted in furtherance of what they believed to be the proper course of conduct in a way that deliberately and knowingly harmed others. When I was hacking, I never set out to harm any person. I tried to minimize damage as much as possible, knowing all the while that even that action was still illegal and would probably lead to my eventual prosecution. So given that they had that same foreknowledge and still continued to act in a fashion that cost people jobs, money, incredible life stress, and most likely a significant degree of trauma, they don't merit the degree of leniency that those who act out of curiosity do, in my opinion.
So you think these guys were malicious, basically? If you had to sum it up into a word, that would be it.
They stated that they were ideologically motivated, but I don't buy that. I think that they were motivated out of a desire to continue the inertia of the coverage of their actions, and they didn't care who they hurt.
So you think they were more in it for the glory than for any sort of broader political ideology? I got to say, too, at this point that I agree with you, but...
Yes, based on my analysis of their actions, their statements, their roles, and their interactions amongst themselves that have been made available to me, that's my conclusion. An entity that's acting for the good of humanity doesn't say, hey, these innocents are acceptable losses, unless it's absolutely unavoidable.
So you're talking about the disclosure of you know, user information and stuff like that, right?
Not only that, but the harm that they did to industry, the harm that they did to the ability of industry to maintain security, and the fact that they, by virtue of the way they went about their actions, for a good period of time until it could be plausibly disclosed what was actually going on, created the impression that the world was just not safe.
So you think, so you're talking about it more of a proposition of general anxiety out there in terms of like anxiety for the average man on the street?
Both that and that of their victims. And I use victims in the sense of people who are harmed by a crime with deliberate motive. You have to understand, a lot of people come to me talking about their hackerish conduct. I do not burn them. I do not turn them in, because it is my belief that the harm to their lives would outweigh any harm that they themselves committed. It's kind of a mathematical matter for me.
So you weigh it up.
Yes. However, in this case, that's not true.
Now, I mean, I kind of thought Lulzsec, when they first popped up, when they didn't claim to have any political motivations, they were just defacing stuff, they were doing it for the lulz, they were doing very funny stuff. I mean, I was quite, there was a part of me that was really enjoying watching them sort of go off and slash and burn half the internet when it was just for the lulz. I kind of felt that they only latched onto the political thing after they got a lot of attraction, in the media. Do you think it's that idea that, you know, once they got all of this press coverage and stuff, that was almost their downfall, is they decided to keep going with it and decided to keep going with aliases? I mean, the whole point about sort of being a part of Anonymous is to be anonymous, but these guys really did want their actions associated with a political ideology and further with their individual handles.
You know, almost a decade ago, I quoted in a cover story for a regional paper, a citation from Dune, which essentially states that anyone who experiences even momentary greatness has to have an appreciation for the sardony of their situation. Should they take it too seriously, even momentary greatness will destroy them.
And you think that's what's happened in this case? They went off and took themselves a little bit too seriously?
I do. I think that they ended up making it up as they went along.
Yeah, I'd actually tend to agree with you on that one. It seemed fairly obvious that the politics stuff came in later and just seemed to be a good fit, and seemed to also be a good way of getting some cheerleaders on side. That seemed to be a part of it.
Indeed. It's convenient and beneficial to assert that one's actions are for a popular political cause. It's much harder to do something and do it for an unpopular cause because you believe it's right.
So what now for Anonymous, do you think? I mean, these guys seem to be some of the most vocal sort of bullhorns. I mean, you and I both know that Anonymous isn't an organization per se. But do you think as a meme, as a concept, that it will continue with the same strength despite these arrests? Or do you, or would you expect that perhaps other, you know, more clearly defined movements will sort of spring up and dominate?
I've actually had something of a debate with a self-styled representative of Anonymous along these lines. They asserted that Anonymous had no leaders, whereas I asserted that what is leader but a person with influence, which these people evidently were.
Yeah, and I've used that exact same analogy in explaining it myself, yes.
Will Anonymous go away as a direct result of this? No, but federal authorities had a great deal of time to source the hell out of Cebu, and I don't think that anybody is truly safe who is engaging in criminal conduct to affect political change. And the up thing is, in other circumstances, when somebody commits crimes to bring about political change, we call it terrorism.
Mm. Well, you do. I don't.
Really? You don't believe that?
I don't believe all crimes designed to affect political change are acts of terrorism. No, I don't. I mean, because you could be describing, you know, anything there. Like,
that's fair. I do accept that there are instances of such thing that may be described as such that would not fairly fall under that definition. However, when you create a climate of fear in an effort to create political change by virtue of your criminal acts, it's hard to escape that kind of classification.
So you think that these guys belong with that designation? Because to me, it seems like a bit of a stretch.
No, but by all means, I do not. I'm simply stating that I see the parallels, and it's ironic that they think that they're so very different.
Yeah, okay. I sort of see what you mean. It's kind of thuggery in the same vein, I guess is what you mean.
In no way do I support the over-proliferation of the use of the term terrorist. It's widely overused in a vastly improper way. I believe that the principal point here is that despite the fact that the community, rather, was allowed to believe that the Lulzsec guys and their Anonymous tie-ins were the king shits all along, they were never as clever or as safe as they thought.
You got to admit their OPSEC was pretty bad.
Indeed. But in that same vein, I would be hypocritical if I did not also say that the OPSEC of some of their targets was pretty bad.
Now, it would be remiss of me not to ask you how the last couple of years have treated you. Obviously, since you turned in Bradley Manning to military intelligence, you've become, you know, somewhat of a hate figure online. How have the last 2 years treated you? I mean, what has that been like for you?
I understood before going forward that people who had not been in such a position, who had not walked in those shoes, who had not been put into a place where they had the opportunity to protect the lives and well-being of others, would not understand what I did. I knew that it would poison my relationship with the hacker community. I went ahead anyway. I accept the consequences.
I guess I'm asking you what those consequences have been. You know, I mean, how has it taken a personal toll?
Let me finish. To my pleasant surprise, it turns out that a lot of people still come to me because they do actually understand. I didn't give them enough credit.
So the reaction hasn't been overwhelmingly negative.
There's a vocal demographic that reacts negatively, but the people who engage in the pursuit of curiosity for the sake of making things different and better, out of a desire to see how the world can be changed by their actions, by their research, rather than doing it in a way that harms others, do understand.
And so, where has life taken you over the last couple of years? I mean, are you working? What is it that occupies your time these days?
I primarily engage in threat analysis and adversary characterization. That is to say, determining what the probable threat to a given information system or organization is going to be before it takes place, as well as the actors who are likely to be engaged in a diverse action against such systems are before they take action, what their resources are, what their funding is, who their sponsors are, and what their motives are.
And who are you doing that for?
Entities who desire confidentiality.
Confidential clients. Well, Adrian Lamo, it's been some time since we've spoken to you. This has been a very interesting chat. Thank you so much for making the time to come back onto Risky Business and have a chat to us about the arrests of key Lulzsec and anonymous people.
No, by all means, I appreciate the opportunity. And as the previously canonical snitch, I feel it's my duty to speak to the issue.
Adrian Lamo there, and for the record, he says Sabu cannot have his infamous snitch hat, his big cap with snitch written across it. He'll actually have to get his own. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, this week's podcast is brought to you by Tenable Network Security, our longest-term sponsor. Tenable has been an unwavering supporter of the Risky Business podcast, and we really, really appreciate it. Each week, our sponsors get to come onto the show to chat about something interesting. And this week, we're going to chat with Tenable's product manager, Mr. Jack Daniel, about a recent Tenable webinar about the politics of security.
Yeah, the webinar was about the politics of security in large, you know, mostly in the enterprise. And a lot of things are more difficult than they should be, or at least at first glance than you think they should be, because it takes a lot of work to get buy-in across, you know, business units, across teams, across divisions, especially in a larger enterprise. Each unit or each division has its own goals. And it's actually been quite an interesting experience for me who, you know, my background, and we've talked about this in the past, is, you know, I'm a small business guy, a small to mid-sized business guy. That's been my background. And I've spent many years as a advocate for small businesses because I really think a lot of innovation and, you know, hiring comes in from there. But, you know, the enterprise is where a lot of people are employed. And you know, there have been a variety of lessons learned. I mean, I won't say they were all surprising, but it's been interesting to see that what it takes to get buy-in across an enterprise. It doesn't require you to make a really good case to the owner of the company or you know, the president of a company of 150 or 300 or 500 people. You just can't, as a practitioner, even as a CISO or CSO sometimes, you can't get the traction to get that all the way to the top of the food chain. And even if you do, that's not going to be pushed back down because that's going to be, you know, delegated back down to someone. And there are a bunch of issues, and they vary from company to company, but it is an interesting situation. And we had some folks that have fought those battles and have the scars to show for it on that webinar.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I can think of at least one company in Australia that offers a red teaming service. And this service is not designed to provide, you know, actionable information to anyone in security at the completion of the exercise. Really, it's designed to get to allow someone like a CSO or a CIO to get buy-in from the rest of the board. Basically, what they want to do is give these guys a trophy list, have them come back with their most sensitive intellectual property, and they want to be able to use that report to scare the willies out of the board, which seems a pretty extreme way to get buy-in. I mean, As a result of this, of these discussions that you guys had, this roundtable sort of discussion that you had, what were the easiest ways to sort of get buy-in? Was it about identifying the right people to influence at the beginning, or I mean, what's the key to success
here? It really, I mean, the key to success really seems to be doing some background assessment of who is a opportunity and who's an obstacle, and there isn't a single this works. The getting the information you need. I mean, even that pen testing one, that's an argument that comes up a lot when people discuss, you know, the value and need of penetration testing. And, it, you know, we certainly address that a lot. People ask us about exploitation. And generally speaking, the logical statement is if we can prove that you're vulnerable to something, why do you need to go through that next step of exploitation? And the reason is that some people you know, like a puppy, need their nose rubbed in it. And it's
how to win friends and influence people, eh?
Yeah, but you're, you know, you're risking, if you're doing it that way, you're certainly risking doing some damage to relationships too. So you have to tap dance around it. You have to know who's where, and you have to sort of trade off, see what you've got that they want. This manifests in a lot of interesting ways.
Well, I was going to ask you for some examples there, if you could.
Yeah, well, one of the examples that really surprised me was last week was, you know, RSA and beside San Francisco. And at RSA, I did a peer-to-peer session on log analysis. And I expected three people to show up, make fun of the beardy guy and leave. And the room was overflowing. Mm. And one of the problems that just was resonated throughout the room was, how do I get access to the data I need, but they won't give me? And this comes right back to...
So this is a political proposition right away, isn't it?
This is a political proposition right away. And these were not all practitioner level. These were some, you know, management and even executive level people saying, I need this. And, you know, in that scenario, what you've got to do is gather what you can without an argument and then see if it's of value to somebody else. And then, you know, start playing games with, I'll show you mine if you show me yours. And leverage that. And, you know, one of the things that works with some of these folks is to step outside of the security role, look at the operational value of some of the information security has.
So what you could sort of offer them, so I imagine you're talking about some sort of application team that doesn't want to give you access to their logs, but right. If you could sort of say to them, well, look, if you give us our logs, we'll draw pretty charts for you and you're developer guys, right? And you like your pretty charts and we'll MRTG it and you'll have a little console and it'll be pretty.
Right. Exactly. We'll share that intelligence with you. You know, maybe the security team is running the SIM or some other way. The other thing that we can do beyond just reporting that data is we can do some correlations. So if the guys that run the mail servers are battling latency or something, they may not have access to the network data. Maybe the network guys have shared with you, or you've gotten the okay to grab span or throw taps in the network, and you've got some data that would help the email team or the web filtering team, which may report to HR, a challenge, you know, sort out some latency issues or some, you know, lost traffic issues, or identify traffic routing based on what you can pick up in parts of the network that may be of interest to the compliance team. But it's about figuring out what you can put together and what you can share in exchange for something else. It's about building relationships.
Let me ask you something. Why would, for example, a mail team say to the security team, no, you can't have our logs? Like, why?
So the good answers are that they are concerned about confidentiality and privacy, and that they may be concerned about, say, if they're in the EU or other places with privacy laws, they could be concerned about privacy. They may not have be comfortable with your team. And the more realistic and unpleasant one is that, you know, they're petty fiefdoms within the companies, and they're all doing power grabs and don't want to play
nice. So they're being children, basically. There's not a good reason.
And it varies depending on your environment. It goes between from one to the other. You know, one of the things that I've seen with one of the very large companies that we're doing some interesting things with is that you know, if you want to put an agent on a machine, you have to make a good case for it. And so,
well, see, Jack, that I understand, because if you're talking right. about making a change to an SOE, that's going to affect a lot of people's lives, Absolutely. You know?
Right. But it's, you know, who does what with the logs? You know, this system doesn't do, I don't want this leaving, you know, I don't want this log leaving this subnet because it's an older system and it doesn't do encrypted
encrypted logging, and there might be some sensitive information leaking logs. I mean, I remember, you know, back manning a couple of snort consoles like a long time ago, you would even have that privacy issue pop up, because occasionally there'd be like a basic string match on something that would pop up in an email coming in or going out of the gateway, right? So that would actually wind up being packet captured and then go into your snort console. So, you know, you're trying to look at what's triggered an alert, and the next thing you know, you're reading someone's mail. So there are some legit concerns.
Some legit concerns, but let's face it. There are we have ways of encrypting traffic on our network segments. Mm. We do have a way, but we have to prove value. And sometimes it's just a power grab. Sometimes there are legitimate reasons. Heavily regulated industries. If you've been a manager of a team that's been beaten for a couple of years because worst case scenario, let's say you're a publicly traded U.S. Healthcare organization. So you have all the alphabet soup of, PCI and HIPAA and GLBA because you do finance stuff and Sarbanes-Oxley and all of those all piled up, and you've been beaten repeatedly, and you're worried for your job and your team's existence. Because you can't manage your system, or you've had trouble, or you never had the resources, and you just keep getting beaten, and somebody asks for data that you feel is sensitive, it's a normal human reaction to say, yep, you know what, you can't have that. I can't risk it because I can't trust you with the data. But that comes back to somebody with a legitimate concern, where you have to build trust, you have to build rapport, you have to have those people skills that, us beardy tech folks are so noted for, and prove some value. And it's not always, sometimes you lose, and sometimes you can go over somebody's head. But in a lot of corporations, if you do that climbing the food chain to get to somebody's boss or their boss's boss to win, you have to remember that you've done that and wonder how many bridges you've burned. And so there are a lot of landmines to navigate.
Sounds fantastic. I'm so glad I work in media.
Well, you know, it's not, you know, the flip side is that there are a lot of companies that aren't that bad. And, you know, mm. you do have to do it. It's not a nightmare, but it's something that, you know, if you're an enterprise, you will run into. I mean, if you're in a small company, you're going to run into people who are harder to work with than others, to be polite. There will be unpleasant people in the office. The larger the company, the more likely that person has a title that could be obstructionist to what you're trying to do. And it may also be true that you don't need what you're asking for. You may have to, you know, step back and think about it. Maybe you really don't need the logs to do what you need. Maybe you don't need full database logging, for example. Maybe NetFlow data on that segment is enough for you if, you know, we're talking about at the data you need.
What you're saying is it's possible that you're the jerk.
That's something that I try never to forget. Having been suggested that I am the jerk more than once professionally, I try not to forget that one. But so you have to think about what you're asking for, too. If every time you walk into a meeting of your peers at work and everyone in the room is a jerk, maybe you should stop and think that maybe there's only one jerk in the room and it's you. But that's a hard one to face, too.
That's a hard one to wrap your head around, and you're ego.
But it's, what are you asking for? And do you really need what you're asking for? Is there a better way to get it? Is there a way to cooperate? And it's how you ask for things, too. It's, I really need to do this because I'm under this regulation. We need to do this. I'd like to do this to minimize the pain to your team to do it.
That's the way to go, right?
Right. Different than I need this.
Yeah.
But it takes, you know, a lot of experience, and some people just say no. And, you know, the folks that were on that webinar have fought those battles, and we all have different scales.
Yep. Now, anyone who's interested in checking that webinar out, I'll post a link along with the post to this week's edition of the show. But if you want to go to Google and tap in The Politics of Security, Getting What You Want, you will be able to find the Tenable Network Security webinar, which I think is hosted by SC Magazine. All right. Jack Daniel, thank you so much for joining us to have a bit of a chat about the politics of security and about how to basically not be the jerk.
Thank you. It's a pleasure as always.
Tenable Network Security's Jack Daniel there with a chat about the politics of security. Now, this week's feature track is by The Basics, and I'm playing it for a pretty specific reason, I got to say. Now, one of my favorite artists in Australia is an individual named Wally DeBakker. He's a really, really good drummer and an amazing vocalist, and also a very nice bloke. I've met him a couple of times. I once interviewed him for Radio National, and I've run into him around the traps a couple of times since then. Now, when I first saw Wally playing, it was with a band called The Basics at the Great Northern Hotel in my town, Byron Bay, and he was playing to a room of about 50 people. It was quite empty, but, you know, immediately I knew I was seeing something special. Yeah, just an amazing singer. And I predicted back then, which was 2007 or 2008, that he was almost certain to hit the big time. Now, people in Australia will know Wally by another name. It's the name of his solo project, which is Gautier. He's had two hits here in Australia, one here a few years ago called Heart's a Mess, and another one more recently called Somebody That I Used to Know. Now, that song already went ballistic in Australia, but since then, it's hit number one in the UK on the charts, and it's currently at number nine on the Billboard Hot 100 in the USA, and it is climbing. So, Wally, basically, you're a f***ing legend. It is so great to see a talented, independent artist like Wally DeBakker hit the big time, because he absolutely deserves it. He's worked so hard, and he is so very, very talented. Now, I can't play Somebody That I Used to Know because I don't have permission to. And Australians are sick of hearing it everywhere anyway because it's getting a little bit on the overplayed side here. But I can play, with permission, this song, Keep the Door Open, which is by his old band, The Basics. Now, it's a bit sentimental, but it is a great tune, and you can get it on iTunes. I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Woman, can you hear? Got me going through. It's like the ghost of what could have been. And I look out for a sign, something to tell me I'm getting through to you. But you close your eyes.
If you ever find a way to make it back to me someday, I'll keep the door open for ya. 'Cause there's a fire burns inside and a love I cannot hide. I'll keep the door open for ya. If you ever find a way to make it back to me someday, I'll keep the door open for ya.